Welcome to this podcast episode from the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, published by Oxford University Press. This episode tells the story of explorer Captain Robert Scott, who led the failed expedition to the South Pole in 1912. Having listened to this life, why not visit the dictionary online? The complete Oxford DNB includes the stories of 58,000 people from the Romans to the 21st century. Further details are available at oxforddnb.com. Robert Scott, known as Captain Scott, 1868 to 1912, naval officer and Antarctic explorer, written by H.R. King. Robert Falcon Scott was born on the 6th of June, 1868, near Stoke Damerel, Devonport, the third of the six children of John Scott, a brewer, and his wife, Hannah Cumming. Robert Scott seemed destined from the start for a naval career. His paternal grandfather and three of his great-uncle's brothers were naval officers, and his uncle was a vice-admiral. When he was 13, he joined the training ship HMS Britannia, and he passed out in 1883 with first-class certificates. For the next 4 years, he served in turn aboard several ships and was, even at this early age, identified as a likely candidate for the leadership of a future Antarctic expedition. In 1887 to 88, Scott studied and qualified at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, with high honours, becoming a torpedo lieutenant first class. Aged 25 and an expert in his field, Scott was growing in confidence and keen for promotion. In June 1899, he learned of plans for a British National Antarctic Expedition. Scott promptly applied for the command, despite, as he later put it, having no predilection for polar exploration. On the 9th of June 1900, a joint committee of the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Society agreed to appoint Robert Scott as expedition leader. At the time, little was known of Antarctica, and Scott's formal instructions were to explore to its eastern extremity the ice barrier discovered by James Clark Ross in 1841. Additionally, he was to ascertain the extent of Victoria Land, explore its interior, and carry out an extensive programme of scientific research. Lacking all knowledge of the techniques of polar travel, Scott first wisely sought advice from an experienced Arctic explorer. Within a year, he had completed the recruiting and provisioning required to overwinter in Antarctica, and on the 6th of August 1901, he and his party set sail in the purpose-built, ice-strengthened vessel Discovery. Scott's official narrative of the expedition, The Voyage of the Discovery, 1905, a classic of its genre, tells the story. The ship's officers were predominantly from the Royal Navy, an exception being Lieutenant Ernest Shackleton, an ex-merchant navy officer. The five civilian scientists included Edward Wilson, who was to achieve a reputation as surgeon, zoologist, and artist, and was to become Scott's close friend and confidant on this and on his last expedition. The Discovery entered the pack ice in January 1902 and sailed the length of the Great Ice Barrier, now the Ross Ice Shelf. Scott surmising correctly that this was no glacier, but a floating ice mass of vast extent. In the Antarctic spring of 1902, Scott, accompanied by Wilson and Shackleton, achieved the then record southerly latitude of 82 degrees 17 minutes south. But the failure of the sledge dogs, signs of scurvy, and the physical collapse of Shackleton compelled Scott to turn back. They reached winter quarters with great difficulty, and having been icebound on the Discovery for a number of months, in February 1904, they returned home in triumph. With 28 sledge journeys accomplished, the ice sheet explored, and a comprehensive scientific programme completed, Robert Scott had more than proved his abilities as a leader of the first scientific expedition to pass two consecutive winters in a high latitude of Antarctica. In addition, the first extensive land journeys into the interior of the continent had been accomplished. On his return to England, Scott was feted as a national hero. He lectured, he socialised, and he laboured at his book. The Navy promoted him captain, which brought a welcome rise in pay, In August 1906, Scott returned to active service, commanding several ships, and in 1909 he secured a home posting as naval assistant to the Second Sea Lord. His professional career seemed assured. However, plans to return to Antarctica to continue the work of the Discovery Expedition were soon to be reactivated by rumours of rival expeditions, and more immediately by Ernest Shackleton's return to Ross Island in 1907 and his near attainment of the South Pole in 1908. By then, Scott had married, in September 1908, the artist Kathleen Bruce. Kathleen, like Robert, was a complex character. Their early courtship was tortured by mutual self-doubt, he thinking himself unworthy of her, she fearing that her own unconventional lifestyle would ill-suit the structured routine of a naval officer. The birth in September 1909 of a much-desired son, the future ornithologist Peter Scott, was to change everything. Kathleen proved to be an ardent supporter of her husband's plans to return to Antarctica. The day before his son's birth, Scott publicly announced his intention to plant the Union flag at the South Pole. In contrast to the Discovery Expedition, Captain Scott's British Antarctic Expedition was a private venture for which he alone was responsible. His reputation as an explorer attracted some 8,000 volunteers, from whom he chose several former Discovery men, including Edward Wilson. While reaching the South Pole was a prerequisite of fundraising, for Scott, the expedition was principally about scientific investigation. Scott left England on board the Terra Nova and reached Ross Island in January 1911. Winter quarters were established at Cape Evans, from where plans were laid for the forthcoming journey to the South Pole. A University of Antarctica with specialist lectures was instituted, and Scott encouraged and contributed to the South Polar Times, an expedition magazine initiated on the Discovery Expedition. On the 1st of October 1911, Scott set out at the head of the main pole party, preceded by two experimental motor sledges, both of which broke down in a matter of days. The first stage of the journey across the barrier was accomplished by a combination of dog and pony transport and man hauling. All went well until the end of November, when snowstorms, followed by blizzards, held up progress for several days, inducing in Scott one of his periodic bouts of depression. However, once more on the Beardmore Glacier, and with the last of the ponies shot for food and the dogs returned to base, Scott could indulge in his favoured method of transport, man-hauling. Aged 43 and the oldest member of the party, Scott contrived ever to be in the lead. With the aid of skis, the treacherous ascent to the polar plateau was accomplished without accident. On the 22nd of December, the first returning party was dispatched, and the final stage of the pole journey commenced. On the 3rd of January 1912, Scott made the fateful decision that five rather than four men should go forward to the pole, namely Scott himself, Captain Lawrence Oates, Lieutenant Henry Bowers, Edward Wilson, and Petty Officer Edgar Evans. On the following day, the last supporting party was dismissed, and 5 days later, Shackleton's farthest point south was passed. Finally, on the 17th or 18th of January, the vicinity of the pole itself was observed. "This is an awful place," wrote Scott in his journal, "and terrible enough for us to have laboured to it without the reward of priority." Then came the feared discovery of a tent belonging to the rival Norwegian explorer, Roald Amundsen. Here Scott found a note stating that Amundsen and his team had reached the South Pole on the 14th of December 1911 and were now on their return journey. Beaten in their attempts to be the first to reach the pole, Scott and his men now began their return journey, what Scott described in his journal as 800 miles of solid dragging and goodbye to most of the daydreams. Robbed of their victory, short of rations, and suffering from the effects of exposure, Scott's party reached the Beardmore Glacier on the 7th of February 1912, where Edgar Evans collapsed and died. Once back on the barrier, Scott, Wilson, Oates, and Bowers struggled on, physically deteriorating in the face of low temperatures, adverse winds, and shortages of food and fuel. On the 16th of March, Captain Oates sacrificed his life for his companions. On the 19th of March, the three survivors pitched their tent for the last time. With Scott incapacitated by gangrenous foot, Bowers and Wilson planned a forced march to One Ton Depot, only 11 miles distant, but never left their tent. With no fuel and only 2 days' food in hand, the end was inevitable. On or about the 29th of March, Scott, probably the last to die, ended his journal with these words: "We shall stick it out to the end, but we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. For God's sake, look after our people." It is a measure of Scott's vitality and strength of will that even at this point he could maintain his journal, write 12 perfectly composed letters to family and friends, and leave a message to the public outlining the causes of the disaster with its oft-quoted words: "Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes and our dead bodies must tell the tale." 8 months later, on the 12th of November 1912, a search party, by some miracle, discovered the tent entombing the frozen corpses, along with Scott's journals and papers. The bodies were buried where they lay, under a snow cairn. A commemorative cross was later erected on Observation Hill, Ross Island. News of the tragedy reached London in February 1913, and a memorial service was held in St Paul's Cathedral. Not perhaps a born leader, Captain Scott nevertheless came to earn the friendship and loyalty of those closest to him. Certainly, loyalty is a dominant characteristic of the narrative accounts that were published by others involved in the failed Terra Nova expedition, including Griffith Taylor's With Scott, The Silver Lining, 1916, and H.G. Ponting's The Great White South, 1921, while Apsley Cherry Garrard's classic narrative, The Worst Journey in the World, 1922, staunchly upheld Scott's qualities as a leader, but was openly critical of his organisation. Following the death of Scott's widow, Kathleen, in 1947, his biographers had a much freer rein. Reginald Pounds' Scott of the Antarctic, 1966, a full-length biography based on family and official papers, was distinguished by its completeness, accuracy, and balance. 2 years later, Scott's private journals were published, exposing for all the full nature of his inner struggles. Less charitable was Roland Huntford's controversial double biography, Scott and Amundsen, 1979, which sought to topple the Briton from his heroic plinth, charging him with incompetence. A decade later, Beryl Bainbridge's incisive novel, The Birthday Boys, 1991, suggested that, to the bitter end, Scott could command not merely the loyalty, but also the love of his companions, and successfully restored the polar explorers to the status of human beings. Cinema, stage, and the television screen have all reflected these ebbs and flows of criticism. The Ealing Studios film, Scott of the Antarctic, 1948, with John Mills in the lead role, was conventionally patriotic and stiff upper-lipped. In stark contrast came Trevor Griffith's 1985 television screenplay, The Last Place on Earth, which was intent on demolishing heroic myth in the wider context of British imperial decay. Of the many public memorials erected to commemorate Scott after 1913, the statue by Kathleen Scott in Waterloo Place, London, is the best known. Behind the heroic image which it portrays lay a complex and contradictory individual. Of medium height, not physically strong, yet possessed of impressive stamina, Scott was by nature insecure and self-doubting, the victim of depressive moods and bouts of indolence. Yet he was ever alert to these disabilities and strove to triumph over them, supported by a deep-rooted sense of justice and a trust in the dispensations of Providence. In his personality and in his prose, Robert Scott was an extreme form of the late Victorian concept of the English gentleman: manly, straightforward, stubborn, unimaginative, and gentle. He sensed his iconic role, and his death in 1912 was soon felt strangely to have foreshadowed the fate of many of his class in the First World War. Having listened to this life of Captain Scott, why not visit the Oxford DNB online at oxforddnb.com? Here you'll find over 100 free podcast episodes, as well as biographies of thousands of interesting people who shaped all aspects of British history.